Blog Talk Radio.
Morning, everybody. This is Kevin Boylo, Nazarita Goldhammer at Epis Radio. We are live coming to you on March 3rd. And the title of the show is Listening and Phenomenology. This is our strategy to deepen the conversation by using a massive theoretical and trans-theoretical toolkit to understand listening. So all too often, we listen in terms of our own mental categories and our own questions. And those questions come from the sedimentation of the self. They come from anxiety, even though people don't want to believe that. That's where they come from. So we've been taught to think instrumentally through cause and effect strategies with our jobs and in terms of an aim or a goal, usually centered around productivity, efficiency, revenue, something like that. And unfortunately, this technolatry, it's a technolatry technique from the Greek technoi, has reduced and funneled the way we think and the way we listen into this narrow bandwidth. And so you could become a great listener in terms of an instrumentalized way of thinking or technolatry, a technologized way of proposing a noetic structure as you experience the world. So coupled with anthropocentrism and egocentrism, you could become a very good questioner, in fact. And you could become a really good listener, but all you would be hearing is your own egocentrism and your own narcissism, your own anxiety, which is different. It means that you've objectified what you're listening to. You create an object that you're listening to. And you use abstract thought. It is alienated. You alienate yourself from a fuller and deeper participation in a concretized experience. So you can imagine that if people are in some kind of interpersonal relationship or even professional, that they could very easily squeeze out deeper elements within the dyad or within the group and only hear a very small amount of what's going on. So for example, in a job function, you might be the manager, and when you have conversations with your employees, you would only listen to them in terms of their job duties, and so it's a very finite system. And then you become a problematizer, and you become a person who achieves regulation, control, managerial manipulation over your job situation or over a relationship. Unfortunately, by objectifying the other and creating a problem or problematizing the dynamic, then you're treating the other like an it. And you're also treating yourself like an it. So you have two its coming together in an isolated, alienated dynamic, who are completely strangulated in their ability to attain deeper understanding, all the reverberations in thought. This is one of the problems in Aristotelian binary logic, the law of non-contradiction. You know, it's either X or not X, but there's nothing in between. And certainly for job functions at NASA, It would be very critical to apply an Aristotelian logic. But in the interpersonal world with other people and other sentient beings, it's fatal. So then we become, in technology, a different kind of being. And so we want to apply this different kind of being to how we listen. It seems really apparent to me that we've developed a super highly functional world, and so we have these mental categories that we try to master, some better than others, and you know we can even think of deeper human experience like love, friendship, despair, hope, courage, these deeper meaning sets that are not quantifiable. They're not calculable with calculus or mathematics or even logic. There's something that's harder, that's more complex. And some people just don't want to do that. It's too difficult for them. They want to problematize everything. Unfortunately, what ends up happening is that the type of listening we do already has set up a range of answers based upon the logic of the listening and the type of either explicit or implicit questioning that's being perpetrated. So here's an example. In psychotherapy, if you have a maltrained psychotherapist who's completely enamored with so-called evidence-based approaches to psychotherapy, they are only going to be looking at certain types of evidence so that they can check a certain box and then pronounce a certain diagnosis and then prescribe a certain drug or a certain kind of treatment. That makes that type of psychotherapist a governmental employee, an agent of bureaucracy, and an alienated human being who's approaching another human being in an alienated way. That's where we are in this culture. That's what's going on. Now let's move to a different domain, the domain of a corporate world. If you work in a corporate job, you have a pretty substantial manual of behavior, what you can and cannot do, what you must do, ranging from your work obligation to your use of communication devices, computer, phone, to what you can say, what you can't say, how you can interface with other human beings. And in the corporate environment now, it's become quite alienated. It is focused on A, money, profits, and B, it's focused on so-called innovation. Well, so-called innovation is just a mechanism. It's a fake concept that suggests that we're going to create something new that'll be exciting, that'll help the human experience. When in reality, it's primarily or solely guided by the quest for profits. And all innovations in the corporate world are designed to make more money, produce more, gain more revenue. They're not motivated by anything else. Now, sometimes we can come up with innovations that accidentally enhance the human experience. But really what's going on, for the most part, if not completely, is that we have a technology. It's an idealization of technique or technology as the new god. Frankly, it's like having a guru. If you go to Silicon Valley, technology is the guru. And there are all sorts of gurus in Silicon Valley. These are people who've become adept at manipulating technology, to produce more profit. What is not said is that the underbelly of that is that when we produce more profit for some people, we take away money and resources from other people. For example, a lot of the minerals and elements that go into computers and iPads and iPhones are so-called precious minerals, and many of them come from poor African countries. So if you do your research, you will find out that those countries in Africa do not profit from, you know, the colonialist Americans coming in and grabbing their precious minerals. Usually it's just a few people or a few families who get paid off. So that countries like China and Russia and the United States can come in and exploit the natural resources of a country and exploit people who are worked to death, for example, in the diamond industry. But it's the same thing that is happening in the precious mineral industry. All for, if you reel it all the way back to Silicon Valley, more profit. And so, unfortunately, so whether you're a corporate employee or you work in a healthcare system or government, you're taught and trained and ingrained and inculcated to think in terms of this techni or technological logic, instrumentalized thinking in a certain way of listening that is a type of listening, but it is not the only type, nor is it a deeper kind of listening, nor is it a participation in the mystery of being. With that comment, I'd like to bring Nazarita Goldhammer out into the show here so that we can talk about listening and phenomenology. And maybe let's think about what kind of listening we could do out in the mountains of central Montana and how that might be different from corporate listening. Nazarita, welcome to the show. We'd certainly like to hear from you.
Thank you. Interesting subject on technology and the use of precious minerals. I was thinking of Greenland. Remember there was this huge blow up about Greenland, people wanting to buy Greenland. And I was like, where did this come from? And then when I had done a little bit more reading, I found that there are a lot of deep precious minerals that are used for technology in Greenland, that now that the ice caps and glaciers are melting, they're exposing this land that is perfect for drilling and mining these minerals. And I just thought, wow, to be in this place, Greenland, where the sound is made by glaciers and the air is pristine and the way that you see things is very different because of the air quality being so pristine. It changes your depth perception and that you can hear all of nature reverberating through the glaciers because it creates this different kind of sound. And I thought, wow, what a change is happening now by the melting of the glaciers that the indigenous people who live there are saying that the sounds are changing, that their whole way of life is changing because of the sounds. Like they have names for different sounds of the glaciers and how they calf and they melt and they boom and they call it something. They have different names. They have hundreds of names for different kinds of glaciers. And the same can be said in places like Montana, the heart of Montana, that there is a different sound quality because I am now in California. The sound quality, I've been very aware of the change that my ears are hearing when I really listen. So listening is definitely something to do, not just hearing, because if I don't listen and I just hear, I totally tune out a lot of natural sounds. I realized this. I was taking a walk yesterday, and I was realizing that in our normal, everyday, hectic life, most people tune out natural sounds, and instead they're very aware of sounds for safety, like cars coming, cars honking, sirens, people talking, people fighting, bicycles, skateboards going by, even talking lights, that we're acclimated to a different kind of hearing rather than the natural hearing in a park or in nature. And people try to get away from urban sounds by going to the ocean, obviously, or going to a forest. And yet we tend to bring technology with us. We tend to bring our phones. We tend to engage in activities that intrude upon the real listening to nature. And I just find that really interesting. So the question that you just asked was maybe how do we listen and how do we use that to listen to places where sound and nature are more alive and are easily accessible, like in the heart of Montana. Since there are fewer people, nature has a way of speaking louder, of us listening and hearing than when we're in a crowded place. So one last thing is that I read this study, and what they found, and through many recordings of nature sounds, that because of the urban environment, birds are shriller, they tend to talk louder, and they talk more than when they used to. They're trying to overcome the din of urbanality. And I thought that was really, really quite interesting. Like nature wants to be heard. And if we're not going to listen, then nature has ways of imposing that listening on us. You know, wasn't there an old saying, something like that? Like, if you listen, you can hear, and if you're not listening, nature is gonna like knock you over the head to listen. Like, you can either listen willingly, or there'll be a great cataclysm where you will have to listen. An example is 9/11, how all the planes stopped flying across the sky, and people suddenly saw that the sky didn't have those chemtrails on them; it was actually blue. And we didn't know that until all planes stopped flying in the air, what it was producing. So sometimes I think we're unaware of nature and the beauty of birds and trees and leaves blowing and, you know, the ground speaking, because we're so involved in our own stuff, you know, our own technology, our own hearing that excludes nature.
Yeah, think about it like this, to all our listeners, that there's not just one way to listen. There's lots of ways: listening to a baby, listening to a spouse, listening to somebody in need, listening to a stranger, listening to a bird, listening to a tree, listening to the wind. And I think it's absolutely true. And I judge this based upon my experience with other people, that listening has been very much hamstringed and technologized, as I said. It's very functional. People will listen in certain ways because they'll have a certain aim with their environment or with another person or another being. But the question is, I think, if we think against ourselves, are we listening to the fullest extent that we can? And are we listening in the right way? Are we listening in the right way? We can listen from fear. Think about, I'm going to use this as an example of how moods, affects, drives, and emotions are situated at the foundation of our being, and they actually determine how we listen. So if I'm a fearful person, or I'm a paranoid person, or I'm an anxious person, then I'm going to listen in terms of those mood structures. Those are modalities or modal units that determine the way we approach our participation in being to the extent that we do participate in being. So if I come into a listening environment, I might not hear very much. Or I might hear differently depending upon the type of modal structure I'm in. Here's a contrast. What if I were to listen without anxiety, without fear, and without paranoia, and I were to listen with agape, the ancient Greek word for wonder? Not curiosity. Curiosity is actually an anxiety-based experience, believe it or not. Just because we're curious doesn't mean that we're actually able to listen or understand in a more deep in a deeper way. And unfortunately, a lot of people have that wrong. Being curious is not a virtue. Having wonder and generosity is a virtue. That's very different because wonder and generosity operate from an ontological floor, whereas curiosity really operates from a primary reflection that's based upon technology, problematizing the situation, and functionality. So there's an instrumental kind of thinking. I listen with curiosity because I'm trying to build a story. So for example, police departments train police officers to listen in terms of curiosity. It's functional. It's a problem to solve. But they don't actually listen to the witnesses they talk to in a deeper way or a potential perpetrator. It's a different kind of listening. And unfortunately, it creates a lot of mistakes. So if you've been trained and structuralized as a person in terms of your interpersonal life, your marital status, your job status, your family status, your religion, your faith, all sorts of, say, demographic vectors, then if you can't get out of those vectors, you will only hear the other in terms of those vectors. And you might argue, well, those are important. That's how we understand somebody. Wrong. Wrong. It's how we understand somebody in terms of the vectors. But if we don't listen beyond the vectors, then we're not really getting a deeper sense of who they are. Now, unfortunately, this is why a lot of marriages fail. This is why there's conflict at work. People don't listen in the right way. Now, to take it to a more extreme level, we don't listen to the inner penetration of the non-human, the nature, the radical non-human. We don't, because we don't have time. We just, as a culture, as a humanity, we don't have time. For the most part, we don't listen, except in terms of how the listening supports the function in which I am behaving. And here's another misnomer, or another mistake. It's a red herring, rather. People who live a highly functionalized life that's completely produced, they're completely subjected to the technical way of thinking. They'll say, well, I'm going to go on a holiday. I'm going to go on a two-day holiday. I'm going to get away from my job. And they go out, get away, but they don't really get away. Everything about the getting away is already pre-structured, prefigured, predetermined by a certain style of thinking and therefore a certain style of listening. And it becomes so ingrained in us and it's so very difficult to hammer and chisel it away. Most people don't want to. So when you take the speciesist, humanist, egocentric, narcissistic self-structure of our culture, where master signifiers, capitalism, revenue, productivity, efficiency. And people are full of anxiety and fear and despair and stress and resentment and frustration. I call it proto-violence. There's a pluripotentiality into violent self-structure. And where people regard even their beloved as an it object, not somebody who's separate, who's different, then we have a setup for massive amounts of conflict, massive amounts of violence, massive amounts of destruction, not only within the human frame or the human civilization, but everything that's outside. So let's meditate for a few minutes on the relationship between humans and domestic dogs. And as I pass the microphone back to Nazarita, let's focus on that. Or let's focus on the relationship between the human and the non-human of any kind. So as I pass this microphone back to you, Nazarita, and let's bracket the idea of the non-human radical other, a conversation you and I have had lately more than once is the power of the specular. So the ocular sees, but the specular spectates. And the power of the specular is that we have spent so much time tuning our seeing or our ability to see as our primary way of being in the world. How do you think seeing is distorted, and how do you think seeing can get in the way of listening?
So you're saying, how can seeing get in the way of listening, and how can listening get in the way of seeing?
Well, not the second one, but the first one. How can seeing, how can the specular, the over-reliance on seeing what we desire, images and media, for example, get in the way of listening?
That's
people would make the argument that we can't listen because we're too enamored with seeing.
Right. I think that's partly, I think it's both. That's why I think listening is so different than hearing, is because if you are seeing something, and this works, I think your question was on domestic animals, and you know, it always gets back to what we eat also. So we see certain packaging, and that packaging says to us that it's food to eat, but we're really not seeing the tie to a living being, animal, that has a heart, that is thinking, that is feeling, that is experiencing life. We refuse to see the tie in that. So in other words, we refuse to hear the cries of the animal when buying packaged meat. We like it to be kind of separate, like this is what this is our food. And yeah, I know in some distant past it was an animal, but really not thinking about that. I think hearing instead of listening can work the same way. Sometimes when we're talking with someone and they say something, we hear it as a phrase, and we immediately turn off. We think that those words mean something different than maybe what the intention was. And I find this really interesting. It's kind of like what we're caught in our culture is this ocular environment that is deeply connected to hearing but not listening. It's hearing certain things, and we like to call these languages, like we like to separate everything into its own language, the language of friendship, right? What is the language of friendship? And it's really funny. I just saw this article today and it was on, some TV show, and it comes on my daily news, and it said, these two people that were on this reality show were learning each other's language of love. And I was like, this is so hilarious, because I thought, here we are. We don't want to open ourselves to deep listening of the other. And instead we want to say, call it, we want to set it.
We want to problematize it. We want to problematize it.
Ultimately, that's really what it is. Like, if you can write this out, what it is, who you are this, 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 then I can say, okay, these three things I can accept or not accept, or accept two but not one. And it's all laid out in this system, which doesn't have any depth. And that's really what we're talking about. That's what deep listening is. And it's kind of like, really, if you want to look at it, it's like deep seeing also. It's like we're so surface-oriented in our haste, in our culture, that we want it all at once. Like, if we don't understand it all at once, we don't want to hear it. We don't want to see it anymore. It's like you're either this or you're not. There's no depth of being. And that's what I found so funny. I didn't read the article, but I just thought the way it was put was really interesting, that they were learning each other's language of love. And I thought, people do this in friendship. Who are you? Can I really be friends with you? What do you like? Do you like these three things that I like? And do you dress a certain way that I like? And if you do, then we can be friends. And instead, people and animals are so much deeper than our shallow way of seeing and hearing, because we're not listening and we're not really seeing either. I observe birds a lot because I feel great affinity for birds, and they talk, but most people are not even aware of any flying birds around. They're totally unaware, except for they don't want crows to take their food if they're out on a picnic, and they don't want birds in the trees because they drop fruit and leaves and they mess up their patio. So do you see, this becomes a shallow way of living. We cement ourselves in these boxes that are not open to anything else but our own, let's call it a language, like our narrow-minded language, and nobody else can come into that unless they fit those boxes exactly. And we're missing out on a world of wonder and beauty and other animals with wonder and beauty that can teach us so much, and the earth and other people. I feel like we're missing out by our constant, rapacious pace of life that we keep, only focused on more. Never, but more is never the more that we should be focused on.
Yeah, I'm getting at what you're saying. So here's the problem, Nazarita. Most people are so, their transcendental structure is so collapsed or condensed that they're in a self structure that can't hear what you just said. This is the problem. We're so contracted that even to say what we're saying, I've noticed in my experience that most people don't understand what I'm saying. Like in this conversation, like there's a deeper level of listening. They're like, deeper, well, that sounds good. Deeper sounds good. Yeah, that would be interesting if I could listen deeper. But they don't understand why it is that we can't listen deeper or more deeply. And here's an example. If you take love between friends, love between strangers, love between colleagues, love between, let's just say, spouses, love between lovers, there are experiences that people participate in. And there can be a shallow experience, or there can be a deeper experience. So a shallow experience would be where you might have a casual boyfriend or girlfriend, And it's just about a hedonistic experience. You know, you go out and you eat food together, you drink booze together, and you have sex together. But there's nothing more than that. That would be what I would call a very functional, instrumentalized type of relationship. And where it's been already functionalized from the very beginning, the always already, the future anterior tense in the French, it's already constructed, and it will never be more than that unless one or both people open up to something different. And that is very different from being a poet and enjoying solitude, or two people really respecting each other and saying, you know, understanding that they might not ever understand each other because we are all different. That the most might be that we would understand our own mind as we perceive the other. But to really get outside of ourself phenomenologically means we participate with the other. And in that moment, participating in being through a non-functionalized modality takes precedence over epistemology. Participating in being becomes more important than knowing. So when people say, well, I'd like to learn more about you, that is a dead giveaway for a therapist like myself. That's a dead giveaway for a person who's in fear and anxiety. They're wary, they're cautious, and they've instrumentalized the dynamic. They've instrumentalized the dyad. And all they're ever going to learn will be a system of pluses and minuses. Plus means, oh, that feels good. Minus means that doesn't feel good. It touches my fear and anxiety. But that's not a way to access the other. Going back to the example of the domestic dog, when I watch most people deal with dogs, their dogs, they've already constructed the nature of the relationship that human is superior, dog is inferior, dog doesn't understand much, human understands much. And there's all these pre-assumptions. And we don't, therefore, understand anything of the dog's experience because we've already framed the experience as an interrogation, as a manipulation, a regulation, and a control. And that's why most people don't learn from animals. On the other hand, if you get out of your own egocentrism and you actually listen to the other, and especially the non-human, the rabbit, the coyote, the wolf, the bear, the dog, the cat, they will teach you more about listening than you could possibly imagine. The horse taught me how to listen to the wind. My horse taught me how to listen to the wind. Hell, I didn't know how to do that until my horse taught me. So there, part of this comes from a set of false assumptions. They're ontological assumptions, right, which we talk about in our concept of eventonomy, kind of an anti-humanist, transhumanist way of reconnecting to the earth, where we're not seeking that sort of power and control and not seeking a narcissistic biofeedback mechanism with what we say. Because what we hear is always in response to what we say or what we see. And if a person would just take a little bit of time to examine what we're saying, I think they would find that there's something to it. Okay, here's another interesting feature of this. The famous dictum, existence is not a predicate. So if you study your grammar, you see that their sentences have two parts, the subject and the predicate. You know, Mary goes to the store. So I'm predicating something of Mary. But if I say Mary is, just the is an ontological moment of being. If I say Mary is sad today, I'm saying Mary is sad, but I'm also saying that I'm also saying that Mary is. So her our very existence is not capable of being predicated. And what that means is we have an expansive capacity for experience inside our own self that far escapes whatever we can make of it through knowing. Knowing is something that is often false, right? We experience that all the time, right, Nazarita? The knowing, the experience of knowing, the aha moment. By the way, the aha moment is one of the great red herrings for young psychotherapists. They want their client to have an aha moment, but an aha moment doesn't really mean anything. It just means a couple of ideas are connecting in the head, but it doesn't mean that there's been any transcendental progress that goes beyond a cathartic experience. So knowing can constrain participation in being. So how do we take these concepts, Nazarita, and relax the hold that seeing has on us to listen more? That's one question. And then the other thing, going back to your example about Greenland and glaciers, your comment about depth perception being altered, I think, is really, really important. And it struck me as you were talking that there's a synesthesia that we might have a greater potentiality for up in the Arctic, up in Greenland, than we could ever have in the middle of a city. A synesthesia, where all senses come together in a very different way. What's your take on that?
That's interesting. I've always thought that we as beings are really have at our disposal synesthesia, that all our senses are actually connected and that they're only disconnected by culture and the way that we grow up, that humans are try to disconnect their senses from one another and put them each in a box so that they can control them better. So I too thought that was really interesting, that the atmosphere changes the way that we see things. And of course, we all live in atmospheres. If we live in an urban area, that may be changing the way that we actually see with our eyes, that it may change the way we perceive depth perception, the way we perceive color, the way that we actually perceive the other. And it also influences the way that we hear. It can't help but do that. So that's a really interesting point. And another point for fighting global warming is, like, what does it take for us to experience a pristine atmosphere? And why didn't we treasure it when we had it instead of, you know, polluting the atmosphere, polluting our homes, polluting our bodies with clothing that has chemicals? Why are we doing this? Do we have, which we've talked about before, do we have a death wish? Why are we eating other animals and consuming the world? Are we so hungry, in a metaphorical sense, to kill ourselves that we're consuming ourselves to death? That's what we're doing. And do we have this,
right,
you know, do we have this drive?
Right.
A really great question.
When you talk about consuming ourselves to death, that is a parallel statement to we live in the mode of killing ourselves, for me.
Right.
We live in the mode of killing the other and killing ourselves. We live in the mode of murdering ourselves. We live in the mode of destruction. We are consuming ourselves to death. We are eating away the planet and all of its resources and all the animals. This is nihilism. And I believe that nihilism has greatly affected our ability to listen at a deeper level. We are completely out of time. Thank you, Nazarita Goldhammer, for being on the show. This is Kevin Boyle from Epis Radio. We're going to come right back next week, 7 days from now, and we're going to continue this exact discussion. Thank you very much.